This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Peniel Joseph, a professor of history at Tufts University, has just published a new biography of the charismatic and controversial black activist Stokely Carmichael, who popularized the phrase black power.
Carmichael was a brilliant political organizer who worked closely with Martin Luther King and became the face of a more radical strand of the civil rights movement. Here he is speaking in Greenwood, Mississippi in 1964, when he was the leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC.
We have to move to a position where we can feel strength and unity amongst each other from Watts to Harlem, where we won't ever be afraid. And the last thing we have to do is to build a power base so strong in this country that will bring them to their knees every time they mess with us.
Stokely Carmichael helped start the Black Panther Party, grew impatient with the slow pace of change in America, and in 1969 moved to Africa, where he devoted much of the rest of his life to a revolutionary Pan-African movement.
Joseph calls his new biography a work of recovery, an effort to reintroduce a man who had a major role in America's civil rights movement, but who's been more or less forgotten by many.
Peniel Joseph is a professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts. His new book is entitled Stokely, A Life. And Peniel Joseph, welcome back to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a wonderful study, a great book, big biography of a complicated life, a man who you call the rock star of black power. And you write this, that he participated in every major civil rights demonstration and development in America between 1960 and 1965. So talk about his place a little bit in the struggle for civil rights in America.
Well, I think he has an enormous place. And what's interesting is that Stokely was born in Port of Spain, Trinidad. So he's got that Caribbean background. He moves to the United States in 1952 when he's 10 years old. He goes to Bronx Science, one of the best public schools in New York City. So he has an unusual background. He's politicized early in the 1950s. One of his mentors is Bayard Rustin, who also knew King, who helped organize the March on Washington. When we think about Stokely, as a student activist, he's enormously charismatic. He goes to Howard University. He had opportunities to go to Harvard, different fellowships. He was absolutely brilliant. But he goes to Howard University because he's interested in what SNCC is doing, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So the sit-in movements of February of 1960 spread throughout the world, really, throughout America. And Stokely becomes one of the key organizers in SNCC. So he's in Washington, D.C., but every summer he goes down to Mississippi. By 1964, when he graduates, he actually moves to Mississippi full time. So what's interesting is that he knows Dr. King before he becomes Black Power's rock star.
Interesting.
He meets King in 1963.
And they cooperated, right? They worked together. They were very much aligned.
Absolutely. There's a deep friendship that develops, even though there's political disagreements. So what's interesting for us about Stokely, even before the Black Power period, he's one of the key organizers of the period. Robert Penn Warren includes him in an anthology called Who Speaks for the Negro? And he interviews Stokely in 1964. That book comes out in 1965. And he interviews Stokely as one of the young leaders of the civil rights movement. Of course, the world doesn't know him until June 16th, 1966. And the clip that you showed, that you aired, where he does his very famous black power speech.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. He was a really charismatic figure, eloquent speaker. So I want to listen to a little bit more of Stokely Carmichael, who begins advocating for a more confrontational approach to civil rights, famously calling for black power. So here he is, October 1966, addressing 10,000 mostly white students at the University of California, Berkeley. College administrators tried to block him from appearing. Gubernatorial candidate Ronald Reagan asked him not to speak, but he took the stage anyway.
Now, we are engaged in a psychological struggle in this country, and that is whether or not black people will have the right to use the words they want to use without white people giving their sanction to it. And that we maintain, whether they like it or not, we're going to use the word black power and let them address themselves to that. But that we are not going to wait for white people to sanction black power. We're tired waiting. Every time black people move in this country, they're forced to defend their position before they move.
So, Peniel Joseph, tell me a little more about what he meant by black power, because, of course, a lot of people read into it all kinds of things. People were afraid of it. People were emboldened by it. It was a controversial thing to say, and not everyone really knew what he was talking about.
Well, Stokely defines black power as radical social, political, cultural, economic self-determination. So from that perspective, and you get it from the clip that we just heard, he's saying black people are going to define identity, politics, their goals, their ambitions, and really freedom and citizenship for themselves. Whites read into that slogan, black power, really violent foreboding, a declaration of race war.
And, well, speaking of race war, one of the things you remind us of is the seriousness and the sort of the ubiquitous violence that, that marked the civil rights struggle, armed police, fire hoses, dogs, bombings, not to mention the violent nature of segregation itself. Given that, I mean, why didn't the Black Power movement that that he represented, and the less nonviolent groups like the Black Panthers, why didn't they gain a greater following?
Well, I think, you know, when we think about civil rights activism, everybody who was a civil rights activist, both African-American, white, Latino, they were outliers. The majority of the country, when we look at public opinion polls, doesn't necessarily agree with civil rights during its heroic period from 54 to 65. Now, you talk about black power, which is upping the ante and saying we want a political revolution. There's going to be even less people who are willing to put their bodies on the line. SNCC famously had a saying, whoever was willing to put their body on the line was the people they wanted by their sides, right? Shared sacrifice. Not many people were willing to. Stokely Carmichael was imprisoned 27 times between 1961 and 1966. Not many people were willing to risk that kind of physical danger for a movement.
Yeah. Well, listening to the tape and listening to him speak, wonderful command of the language. Obviously someone full of passion, full of sort of political rage. But what was he like personally? I mean, I understand eloquent, warm, charismatic.
Yeah, Stokely had friendships that transcended racial lines. He went to a predominantly white, predominantly Jewish school. One of his closest friends is Jonathan Daniels, who dies and is killed in Alabama, who's a white seminary student. So he's somebody who got along with everybody, irrespective of political differences. So he attracted a huge following. I mean, he had an entourage before he became this Black Power icon. Once he becomes famous, very famously, Ebony Magazine is saying friends are calling him the Magnificent Barbarian. And they're comparing the way he looks, because he's so impossibly handsome, to a statue of a Nubian god. So he is like a rock star. I mean, he goes to different college campuses and there are men and women just surrounding him like they've just come and attended a musical performance, but he's actually giving political speeches.
Right. So in 1969, at the height of the sort of chaos of the civil rights struggle, Stokely Carmichael leaves America for Africa, changes his name to Kwame Ture, lands in Guinea, embraces Pan-Africanism. First, why did he leave America?
He left America for two reasons. One, he was being hounded by the FBI, State Department. President Lyndon Johnson demanded twice weekly reports on his activities. And he had done an earlier five-month tour of the world in 1967, where he went to Cuba, Vietnam, and Africa, that literally scandalized the United States. People were calling for his deportation. Lyndon Johnson wanted to try him for sedition and treason because of his anti-Vietnam War stance. He also leaves because not only is his life in danger, he is drawn to Africa. He marries Miriam Makeba, who's this beautiful international South African singing
wonderful
star.
Wonderful singer. I learned this from your biography. I had no idea they were married. Amazing.
They were married for 10 years. And so they become this global sort of Pan-African couple. And he believes that Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Touré and their vision of sort of a United States of Africa, one army, one leader, one nation, can actually galvanize the black movement in the United States.
Yeah. You write that when Stokely settled in Africa, in Guinea, he embraced an authoritarian president, and you write a country with less political freedom than the one he had left behind. So how did he reconcile that apparent conflict of his life in Africa?
I think his politics, when he moves and becomes Kwame Ture, he goes from being a local political organizer, national political mobilizer, an icon, to really more of a revolutionary political ideologue. And so as an ideologue, there are contradictions. There are ironies. For him, the very fact that Sekou Touré and Guinea were anti-imperialist and were supporters of the African Revolution and anti-colonialism justified whatever contradictions or imperfections of that society. Critics were much more vociferous, but what he said is that the United States was in no position to judge because of Vietnam, because of racism.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions you raise about his move to Africa is did he turn his back on blacks in the U.S. in their moment of need, in their hour of need?
You know, he would say absolutely not, that we are all Africans is one of Stokely Carmichael Kwame Ture's signature phrases, along with ready for revolution. That's how he answered the phone. He'd say by going to Africa, he was actually providing a headquarters and a legitimacy for the Black American freedom struggle. Critics said, no, you should stay here and fight the good fight here. But remember, Carmichael always feels like he's a citizen of the world. When we think about the arc of his life, he only lives in the United States from 1952 to 1969.
Yeah.
So it's 16 years, but it's 16 years that are incredibly historical and brilliantly creative in terms of what he does for race relations in the United States.
Interesting. You note that Stokely Carmichael's time in Africa affords him a sort of political maturity that was denied to Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, who, of course, were cut down at a much younger age. How does his mature voice differ from the younger radical?
Well, the mature voice is more strident. I mean, as Kwame Ture and as a revolutionary ideologue, we miss some of the poetry that we had seen the younger Stokely Carmichael. The younger Stokely Carmichael asked a lot of questions, right? Kwame Ture is arguing that he has the answers, and the answers are revolutionary Pan-Africanism, scientific socialism. So it definitely is more strident, and it's less flexible than he had been in his earlier incarnation.
Yeah. In toward the end of the book, you have a beautiful paragraph that's sort of summing up a lot of what you feel about this. You say, in the 1960s, Stokely Carmichael transformed American democracy and race relations. In doing so, he achieved a level of political notoriety that rivaled, indeed at times surpassed, that of Malcolm X. Poised between Malcolm's sword and Martin's shield, Carmichael deployed both in an effort to reimagine America's purpose, destiny, and soul. It's a beautiful paragraph. It raises the question, though, why do we remember Malcolm X and Martin Luther King with such reverence, with such sort of clarity, in a way that we don't remember Stokely Carmichael?
I think a couple of reasons. One, he leaves for Africa, so he's away from our gaze. So once you're away from that American gaze and the media, the celebrity dies down. Also, he's not martyred. We tend to remember people from that era, unfortunately, who were assassinated. And Malcolm and Martin were martyred. And then finally, I think it's very tough to put Stokely Carmichael in a specific box. Violence versus nonviolence. Militant versus reformist. Civil rights, black power. He's all of those things in different ways. So when we think about Stokely, it's tougher to put him in a little box.
Interesting. You describe, as we mentioned, this biography as an act of recovery. So what drew you to this act of recovery? Why is it so important to recover this legacy of Stokely Carmichael?
Stokely came into my consciousness when I was in junior high school through the television series Eyes on the Prize. And there's a local connection because Henry Hampton, Boston-based people like Judy Richardson, who's a SNCC activist, Callie Crossley, the journalist, all worked on that series. And when I saw Stokely Carmichael, I knew who Malcolm X was. I became completely invigorated. I wanted to know who this young man who looked the way he did, sounded the way he did, who he was.
Interesting. What if he were still with us? What do you suppose he would make of the state of race relations in 2014 America, looking around, a black president, obviously dreams unfulfilled, but what would he make of it?
I think that Kwame Ture, the political revolutionary, would say that these are the contradictions of American capitalism, American imperialism. I think he would understand the black community's really love and adoration for Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. And I think that because he believed in black united front and black solidarity, he wouldn't personally demonize the president, even as he would be critical of his policies.
Yeah. You know, you have a great detail in this book, the sheer range of people that he influenced. They include Mumia Abu-Jamal, an imprisoned former Black Panther, to Brian Lamb, the founder of C-SPAN.
Yeah, and Brian Lamb has the great story of how he first saw Stokely Carmichael at a church in the 1960s deliver a great speech. It was about 30, 40 minutes. And that evening on the news, Brian Lamb saw the 2 minutes of the most incendiary parts of what he thought was a really thoughtful speech telecast, and that really inspired him to create a vehicle where people could deliver speeches and addresses from start to finish, no interruption, no commentary, and that's how we got C-SPAN.
That's amazing. It's amazing to think of the range of folks that he influenced. Well, Peniel Joseph, it's a wonderful study of an important subject. Thank you so much for coming in to talk about it. We're very grateful.
Thanks for having me.
That's Peniel Joseph, professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. He's the author of a new biography, Stokely, A Life. Peniel, thanks again.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Our show is produced by Amory Sievertson, Dina Rosendorf, Alex Kingsbury, Emma Jean Weinstein, and Kathleen McNerney, with help from Jamie Bologna and Anna Taylor.
Tim Skoog is our technical director.
We had help this week from Eddie Mazulis.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.